Diane Howes, and I'm co-curator of In Cloud Country.
I'm Ivona Blaswick. I'm director of the Whitechapel Gallery, but also guest curator of Cloud Country, working with Diane Howes.
What first inspired you to do a show about the abstraction in nature?
Well, it's something I'm personally very interested in, both, I suppose, as a curator, but also as an artist. It's something, it's a kind of thread through my own work, and I find a lot of works that I look at and enjoy have some sort of relationship to that notion as well.
So with the curation of the show, I noticed that there's a lot of thematic rooms that tend to group together particular works. And I was interested to see, you know, you've got Paul Nash next to Bridget Riley and Chris Ofili next to Turner. I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about those kind of curatorial choices.
We felt we had a license to do this, partly because we had both seen an exhibition at the Whitechapel Gallery in the 1990s curated by Michael Craig Martin called Drawing the Line, where he'd just run amok with a whole collection of drawings, and you could see Leonardo da Vinci next to Sol LeWitt, next to, a contemporary. It was really liberating, I would say. And so we thought, why not travel across space and time and see if the concerns are the same? And sure enough, we discovered that there were these extraordinary parallels. So, for example, we could see that you could put together an incredible oil pastel by Degas and find it next to a contemporary watercolour by Julian Opie. They're both intimations of something sublime, except the Julian Opie has a motorway in it. And so it was looking at the similarities, but also the differences. And rather than telling this story as a chronology, it was to actually say there are various themes in this topic. Because the word abstraction is as big as the word nature, and we wanted to find all the different manifestations of it, hence the grouping into different themes. We also found that we could take the lead from artists themselves. So when we found in London a beautiful Ben Nicholson of a tree trunk next to a column, it was one of those crazy penny drop moments of course, yes, that's where columns come from. But at the same time, realising that there were a whole group of works which were about architecture in a way, verticality, balance, composition. But then there were another group of works like the Paul Nash and the Bridget Riley, which were about capturing movement. So to go through those different themes, the first one is really looking at formalism. And it works in two directions. One is artists who use an incredible economy of means to evoke a landscape. For example, they might draw a straight line from one edge of a rectangle to another, and bingo, it's a horizon. But then others use it as a way of jettisoning the original and landing you in pure experimentation with form. And that would be, you know, someone like a very contemporary artist, Mark Francis, who looks, I imagine, at a microscopic cell and sees patterns in that. Or someone like Gary Hume, who will take the leaves of the petals of a flower and make it this very beautiful symphony of line and colour. Or Matisse, who takes a fern and makes it just this incredible eye-popping two silhouettes of black and red. So we were looking at it in those two ways. And I'm going to hand over to Diane, because the next bit of it was looking at nature as a process.
There's a notion about, if you work with nature, that it's about trees and landscape seen from a certain perspective. And of course that isn't necessarily so. You know, I mean, nature is everything, really, in our physical world. You know, I mean, it's gravity and radiation and, you know, the movement of the planet and so on. And I think there's a thing, a lot of artists actually are working with that notion in the broadest sense, even though they're not in any shape or form landscape artists or you know, working with any sort of necessarily recognisable things. So there's a kind of idea about how we see that landscape or experience that physical dimension of our life. And the traditional view is from standing up from eye level, we look out towards the horizon, and that horizon is intersected with trees or rock formations or other elements. But of course there's an idea that you can look at landscape from above, look down on landscape. And in some ways that's quite a recent idea, maybe to do with, you know, human beings flying in aeroplanes. But maybe that's a leap of imagination as well, because if you look at quite early art, some forms of rock art, you'll see a similar thing going on where actually they're looking at the land as a map from above rather than from a viewpoint. And then the thing Ivona was talking about the process, if you're working with this sort of, or from this broad notion of physical experience and the nature of the world, obviously, traditionally, people would work outside and look at the subject matter, but a lot of artists actually work in the studio, completely removed from that stimulus. So there's a notion there of memory, an embedded memory, and, you know, a kind of perhaps a personal memory, but also maybe some sort of ancient memory that we all have of these elements. And then even the materials that you are using, carbon black, I mean, it is, or certainly was originally, made from burnt substance, carbon being the thing which is the basis of all life, obviously. And then a lot of the earth pigments and so on as well are literally made from the earth. Burnt sienna, you know, was made from, you know, earth. So you're taking these, you know, this is in a way why it does become chemical or maybe alchemical, taking these substances and dissolving them, you know, mixing them with water or oils or other chemicals. And then when you're using those substances, these mixtures, these chemical mixtures maybe, or even graphite, again, what a wonderful charcoal, that's burnt wood, you know, wonderful stuff. And when you're using these things, obviously, there is a kind of chemical nature to them, which appertains to the real and natural world. So the flow of the water and pigment is what water does and what the earth does. So there's some sort of equivalence going on there in the making of the work.
You know, we've got these terms like abstraction and nature, and they seem to be quite kind of very broad in their scope. And I was just wondering if there's any kind of... where would you draw the line, is what I'm trying to get at. Is where do things stop being abstract and start being representational, for example? Or when do things stop being natural? And if they do, what are they then, I suppose, is the question.
I think that's a really good question and a really difficult one, because exactly, where do you draw the line? And if you look at something, you know, like the Goethin drawing in the exhibition, or the Kopman, I mean, actually what you're looking at is a flat bit of paper with some little scribbly marks made with a pencil. And yet somehow what you're seeing is this beautiful landscape or these trees by a lake. But in fact, the actual thing that's being used there is completely abstract. It's a grey line on a piece of paper, and there's some sort of correlation there to this idea of poetry as well, whereby poetry can be quite economic in the way it describes something, but it is very strongly, very evocative, very powerful nonetheless. I mean, Ivona might like to...
Yeah, I think we're also looking at abstraction where art becomes a symbol or the nature becomes a symbol. So we've got a grouping of work around art and nature and society where we start with William Morris. And even though the drawing that we have, which is the design for a wallpaper, is really very precise, picture of petals and flowers and tendrils and so forth, the concept, I think, is an abstract one in the sense that he reflected the anxiety that artists had at the time of the Industrial Revolution, particularly in this part of the country, where artists could see the satanic mills and the way that human beings were losing touch with their environment and destroying it at the same time. You know, belching smoke, mines, factories. And so the project there was to bring nature back into an increasingly urban society and to have nature in the home. So that then is picked up by Rachel White-Reed, who we commissioned at the Whitechapel Gallery to make a frieze for our exterior, which was an arts and crafts motif called the Tree of Life. And you see that in many 19th century buildings. In the middle of the city, and in one of the most impoverished parts of the city, the Tree of Life became a symbol of hope and renewal. Or we see, Rachel talks about also being inspired by what she calls Hackney weed, or buddleia, which will grow anywhere. We see artists like Michael Landy celebrating the weed and the resilience of nature in the city, that it can poke up through a pavement or a building facade. And he does this beautiful drawing of a buttercup, which is also medicinal, it turns out. So we're playing with the term abstraction and seeing how it becomes symbol as well, how it becomes politics. We have a room where we have artists like Eve Tongi taking art into the realm of the imagination and the unconscious. There's an amazing imaginary beachscape which has many aspects of a kind of Freudian reading of the unconscious. We have an artist like Imran Qureshi, on the other hand, who trained as a miniaturist in Lahore. He's a contemporary artist from Pakistan, who uses his extraordinary skill at depicting chrysanthemum petals and turning those into quite a shocking image of political trauma. And that image is really about partition, it's a bloody footprint. But when you look more closely, you see it's made up of these beautifully, exquisitely rendered chrysanthemum petals, and it's embossed with gold. So we're also interested in how artists have abstracted nature into the realm of politics or into the realm of metaphor or memory, imagination, and symbol.
One of the themes that seemed to run through for me was the idea of nature and articulation, and how nature can, one, be articulated, two, nature can be articulated as a kind of medium in the way that Joseph Beuys does in his, when he's using things like fat and other things. Yeah. And then again with Joseph Beuys actually trying to articulate nature as, in a sense, of creating the aura borealis over New York. I was just wondering if that is the kind of thread that has, you kind of thought of when you were coming up with this, or whether that's just my own reading, as it were.
Well, I think it absolutely, that's a very astute observation of something which I think dominated post-war art, which was so-called conceptual art, where language becomes another form of representation. And the idea of a proposal, such as Paolo Bruschi's idea that he could colour the clouds over New York, or indeed Lawrence Wiener, who's one of the greatest conceptual artists in the world, evoking a structure made out of bamboo purely with words on the wall, And the economy of means, but also the, I think, enormity of the effect is really interesting. I think it, throughout the whole thing, you get this miraculous process, this alchemical process of how artists can reduce an entire environment, a huge 360-degree panorama, into a square of paper. How do they do that? And we're saying this is how, you know, this is what these are some of the many, many ways over three centuries that artists have done this and continue to do so, continue to be deeply engaged with it.
Okay. So what would your message then be to, you know, people who are maybe sceptical about either coming to an art exhibition that is about nature, for, you know, they might see that as a traditional thing, or for people who are maybe put off by contemporary or conceptual art?
Well, this exhibition, of course, has something for everyone, partly because of its setting. You'll be travelling through a capability brown landscape to get to it. You'll be entering, you know, one of the most beautiful 18th century houses in Britain. But at the same time, the span of historical periods, I think, is what's so exciting about it, that you have these great acknowledged art historical giants like Turner, like Cotman, but seen at their most intimate, you know, the sketch, the sort of deftness with which they capture something with pen and ink or with watercolour, juxtaposed with some of the most important developments in modern and contemporary art. We do span all three centuries. It has inevitably a strong locus in the British art scene and in British collections. We're sad not to have Van Gogh or Mondrian or the Barbizon School, but we do have a Degas and a Matisse. You know, we've sort of tried to map the key movements right up to Richard Long, perhaps one of the greatest post-war British artists, who uses his body as a form of mapping and describes his journey across the moorland to create a sort of conceptual sculpture. I think there's a lot of fun as well. Henrik Håkansson has made a vinyl record, which is the Dusk and the Dawn choruses. There's politics. Amy Balkin, who produced postcards at Documenta, which is a huge international art exhibition visited by 850,000 people. And she asked each one of them to send a postcard to the United Nations, asking that UNESCO declare the atmosphere as a World Heritage Site. So there are probably sacks of postcards driving a UNESCO official crazy at this moment. But she's flagging up that we're in danger of losing this great ecosystem, that we're in danger of irrevocably destroying it. And I think that's another part of the message of the exhibition. There's pleasure, there's excitement. There's the sublime, but also there's anxiety about losing this great thing.
I suppose we're talking about boundaries and lines again, and we've got the lines between nature, design, cartography, almost mapping nature and designing nature, because I recall the kind of galaxy of trees and, you know, the things like that. I was just wondering if you could tell me a little bit about, you know, to what extent kind of mapping and those ideas come into the exhibition.
I think mapping comes as a way of documenting a journey, but it's also part of a different kind of take, which is quite activist, actually. There's a work by someone, an American artist called Agnes Deans, and she finds places in America where there's been intense deforestation, and part of her work is negotiating for that land to be reforested. And her drawings are about the planting of the trees. So also there's the element of time travel, because we've juxtaposed her work with the work of Yorkshire artist Henry Moore, who's really about the deep time of geology of the past, which makes our human time seem minuscule and fleeting. And she and an artist like David Nash are both planters, and they're about the future. They're about imagining what this thing will look like when it's fully grown, which resonates with the landscape here anyway, which was planted in the 18th century by Capability Brown who must have persuaded his clients that they should wait 100 years to see the full impact of his work. So I think there's an element of time travel in this as well. I think, finally, it's the most museums tend to privilege oil painting and objects, sculpture, bronze, marble, and so on. And what's thrilling about working with works on paper is that they're rarely seen, because they tend to be relegated to, you know, smaller galleries or into storerooms. But they also have this kind of what-if potential about them. I think they're quite utopian. They're about grabbing something fleeting. They're about the possibility of something more. And that, I think, gives them a tremendous energy that sometimes oil paintings lack. So I hope people will come away feeling excited and may even grab a pen themselves and find themselves, you know, also drawing and reacting to the natural environment around them.
Thank you, yeah.
Can we ask you a question, Jim?
Yes, you can.
It's not a trick question, really. Just wanted to say, obviously, you're, you know, an arts historian of some note and a writer and so on. So what was there sort of a particular juxtaposition or an element that you felt drawn to or not?
I was really struck by the linking of Chrysophelia and Turner. The palm tree with the roots revealed, and then almost a skeletal sketch by Turner. I suppose it is a kind of sketch, isn't it? I just thought that was brilliant. I thought that was really inspired, and you know, you talked about the Freudian thing. You know, you've got all the kind of underground nature that you don't see, and that became part of a Felix thing. And then you had the same kind of thing about the painting itself, about the sketch itself by Turner, where you're seeing almost his foundations for something bigger and better. And I thought that was kind of a really cool link. So. Yeah. But I think more than anything else, I was just surprised by, you know, that, like the bloody foot, the bloody footprint. I thought that was, you know, quite shocking to see amongst these natural things, because for a while I was looking at it and I was thinking, is that actually blood? You know, is that someone's real bloody footprint?
And it's very unsettling, isn't it? That
that entire room is claustrophobic, and just the curation of it is, it's just really kind of, I don't know, I think it's probably the way that the painting's leading at you. It's almost like you're going to be crushed at any moment by these kind of dark, sinister forests, and, you know, it's, really, really fascinating. I think that might be my favourite room, actually. Because more than any of the others, I felt the kind of, I mean, maybe it's just because of the feeling of claustrophobia or whatever. I think it's quite a powerful feeling, and when you get that, you know, that's what is next then?
Well, rather than publishing a catalogue, we are going to publish a little book to accompany, as a result of this exhibition. And what it will comprise is an image of every work accompanied by a quote from the artist or one of their contemporaries. And so that's been a real kind of voyage of discovery, of actually finding artists in their own voice, talking about the methodology, talking about the inspiration and the intention of the work. So we hope that it's going to be a little bit inspired by those old Ladybird books, the Ladybird Book of Nature or the Oxford Book of Butterflies, that kind of style. But we hope that it's going to be a really useful tool. It's an anthology of thoughts and writings about method and process, about abstracting from nature. That'll come out in a few weeks' time, later in May, we hope. And then there'll be a launch for that at the London Art Book Fair at the Whitechapel in September, Whitechapel Gallery, September 20-something or other.
And what's the title of the book?
In Cloud Country, Abstracting from Nature.
When will people be able to come and see this fantastic exhibition?
This exhibition is open now. It's open 7 days a week.
It's on until the 30th of June. So, you know, please take the opportunity while you can of coming to see these works.
I thought I might just add again that one of the great revelations for us curating this exhibition has been to discover the masterpieces that are available in the north of England. There are many works drawn not only from Harewood itself, but also from the Hepworth in Wakefield, the New Art Gallery in Walsall, Mima in Middlesbrough, and I must say that colleagues have been fantastically generous in opening up their stores to us, as well as London galleries and collectors up and down Britain. So there's a strong British focus in the show, but I think what people will discover here is some of the treasures that are just, you know, within the area. And we hope that that will lead them back to those collections as well.